All right, everybody, welcome into a must-win game with Maggie Gray. I'm so pleased today to be talking with one of my former colleagues at Sports Illustrated, but that was just one of his very memorable stops. Player agent, a vice president with the Green Bay Packers, a consultant for the Eagles, which I didn't know about the Michael Vick story until I read this book, so a little on that later. A media personality, TV, radio, podcast, a successful newsletter, a professor at distinguished universities such as Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania, Villanova, and now the author of an incredible book called Smarter About Sports, My Life Navigating Athletes, Agents, Media, and the Business of the NFL. Andrew Brandt is here. You're also a father. You're a husband. Did I leave any other things out?
Triathlete. You know, I think I'll say this. I left the Packers 16 years ago. It's hard to believe now. And in some ways, as you just mentioned, I've been a lot busier than when I had a quote unquote full-time job, but I love my life more now because it's autonomous. You know, yes, I'm a law professor, but I can control my schedule there. Yes, I write, I can control my schedule, podcast, all my consulting agreements on NIL, all the consulting I've done with agencies and with the Eagles. A lot of it is under my control. And I think just sort of a general lesson to start out the podcast is that's what people really want. You know, if you ask people about their job, really, they're not going to talk so much about the money making them happy or the hours. It is the hours. It's the autonomy. It's being able to do what you want to do when you want to do it. And I say again, 16 years, I really haven't had a quote unquote job, but people are amazed at all the things I do. Well, I can do them with autonomy. And as you mentioned, spending time with my boys, spending time on my fitness, I work all that in. Those are non-negotiables for me.
I love the book and the stories are fantastic. It's absolute must read, not just for NFL fans, but people who are just sports fans in general, because you've done much more than even just the NFL. But what was the most challenging part of writing the book? And I have to imagine leaving some things out. You were generous at some point, not name names. And I'm curious how tough that was.
Yeah. I mean, I did a deal with Triumph. They do a lot of sports books. They're out of Chicago. And we went through a process and landed with Triumph. And I had a wonderful editor, Michelle, who actually covered the Packers years ago, which is such a coincidence. And I think, Maggie, my final version to her was, I don't know exactly, but 120,000 words. The book is around 81,000 words. So in those 40,000 words, there are a lot of things where I decided after the fact, or she decided, just not right. I think this is what I've tried to do in my columns for Sports Illustrated, for ESPN, and initially for the National Football Post, was, how do I say this? Be honest and be measured together. So I'm not necessarily talking flowers about everyone, but I don't play the game of takedown. I don't play the game of catch-all. This is not something new to my book. This is the way I am personally, and this is the way I've written for 15 years. This is the way I do podcasts, this is the way I act on Twitter and social media. Yes, so I'm honest. You know, one thing that maybe differs me from so many people that left the NFL or NBA or whatever, I never wanted to get back in. I never did. You know, it's like I left the Packers and that was mutual. You know, my contract was up. They're feeling like, yeah, you had a nice run. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I had a nice run. And I was on to other things immediately, media, academia, and all the other. And I never looked back, never looked back. So it allowed me in my media career to be honest. And again, no gotchas, no takedowns, just honest about my experiences. And the one thing I'll say about stories, this is in the preface of the book right away. You catch people by stories. I've been teaching for 16 years. I teach through stories. I lecture through stories. The best way to teach someone, the best way to engage someone, the best way for them to walk away with a lesson is stories. This book is literally hundreds, as you know, hundreds of stories. And I've led a fortunate life through all my stops. I appreciate you going from growing up a little kid in Washington, D.C. all the way till now. I got it all in there. And it was just spilling out my guts of my life.
Great anecdote in the story of you getting a phone call out of the blue from Raiders legendary owner Al Davis, who knows you grew up in Washington, D.C., and just goes, so do you know Elgin Baylor? Like somehow you and he would have been friends. I mean, just great, great details in the book. So what is the lesson that people should take? Let's just dive into two of the most famous and interesting people you had up close and personal view to, Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers.
Yeah.
What's the lesson you can teach off of those two being together in the same building? And then obviously where Brett has gone and now where Aaron is continuing to play.
You know, I'll say this, first of all, I'm probably going to get pushback from people like, oh, you were so nice, those guys. Look at their crazy views on this or that or what's happened in the past 10 years. Listen, I talk about my experiences with them. 9 years with Brett, 3 years with Aaron, stayed in touch with Aaron after that, and stayed in touch with Brett somewhat. But I am very positive on those two. You know, I learned a lot about team building in my life. And one thing that you are absolutely golden with is if you're best players are good people. Excuse me. Brett was good people. I mean, Aaron was good people. And they led. Some people think they didn't lead. They led. They led their team. They were looked up to by their teammates. And both of them had these interesting relationships. I would call them back of the room relationships. Very close with trainers, equipment guys, security guys, maintenance guys. And I just saw those relationships develop. I also talk about the afterglow. This is what I look at when I see interactions between famous people and other people, especially disabled people or children. When the interaction ends, I look at the child. I look at the disabled person. The athlete is gone. And I love that glow. They're looking at their friends, their family, their mom, their dad. And that is what we all do this for. Brett and Aaron both lingered with these people. And it warmed my heart because they could have just done the perfunctory, how you doing? But both of them I saw would really linger with those people. Now, let's talk about the two of them. In no other walk of life, Maggie, no other walk of life, would you put in a room for 5 hours a day, country Mississippi and Northern California cool, and say, get along? That's hard. You know, everyone knows this story. I've told it a million times. Others have told it. We had the 24th pick in the draft. We didn't want to take a quarterback. None of the guys we wanted, DeMarcus Ware, Marcus Spears, all these guys, gone. So we had that combustible moment. Like, are we going to do this? Are we going to take the only guy left on the board with a first-round grade who happens to play the same position as our star player, who's the most durable quarterback in the history of the NFL? And there was pushback from coaches who knew that if we took him, he wouldn't help us this year, next year, maybe never. And then Ted Thompson, to his everlasting credit, just said to us, boys, what do we always say? Trust the board. And we trusted that board in the face of a lot of negativity. He stood fast and said, we're taking the best player available. We've just had 6 months of our seven scouts going around the country, and they've arrived at this name. If we dip into our second round grades to take a defensive lineman or cornerback, what are we doing? Like, what do we stand for? And I know there are organizations around the NFL with decision makers that would do that because, hey, we don't need a quarterback. But we did. And what I point out in the book is after the pick, by the way, after the pick, Brett calls the coach, Bus Cook, the agent, calls me, what the F, you know, our Lambeau Field party is booing us. We feel it through the walls. We get D's and F's from ESPN and NFL Network, you know, and Brett, everyone's upset. But what then people turned away, right? The general populace, okay, they did that, turned away. But myself and John Schneider and so many others had to manage this. We had to manage this. You know, we're bringing in a guy where Brett Favre is saying to me, or actually Bus, every week or so, Andrew, do you know what it's like to come into work every day and sit with your replacement? It's no fun. I'm like, yeah, I understand. And Aaron's people are like, Andrew, he's never going to retire. Like, are you going to trade Aaron? What are we doing? So I sort of went through that and in the book, like these are management. And it leads to a bigger point, which is that throughout my career, I was called this cap guru. I was called, you know, number. No, numbers are easy. You know, numbers can be handled with a nice calculator. It's people, it's relationships. And that's what you need. I never underestimated the power of ego and insecurity. When I'm doing contracts, whether for a player as an agent side or team side, it's all ego and insecurity. The player doesn't care if he's making 5 million, 10 million, 20 million. The players care if those peers are making less or about what he's making. You know, with Brett, it wasn't like, hey, Andrew, I got to have 15 million a year. No, he wanted to know, am I being paid fairly compared to, at that time, Troy Aikman or Drew Bledsoe or Steve McNair? Those were sort of the peers, and that's what they really care about. And so I learned through all my dealings, like, this is about people. You deal with the same people coming in as you do. We deal with the same people when you have no leverage as when you have a lot of leverage. And football, sports, business is a very, very small world. Same people all the time.
And you got to keep your reputation intact, right? You want to be somebody who agents want to deal with. It's part of the reason why the Packers brought you in as a former agent. They wanted to be more agent friendly, yeah. Someone who had been on the other side. Was the team ever close to trading Aaron Rodgers?
Only right before we picked him. You know, Ted said, get him on the phone. I got his agent on the phone and I'm making those poor guys wait another excruciating 12, 13 minutes after he'd been sitting there 6 hours, after the caterers stacked the tables, tapping their feet, when are you going home? And we just wanted to see if that phone would ring. You know, if we got an offer that Ted couldn't refuse, I don't know what the offer would have been. Two seconds and a later, I don't know. Maggie, that phone never rang. Sometimes in watching the NFL the last 20 years, I'm like, what if that phone rang? You know, what if that phone rang? Could look a lot of different.
We'll all remember Aaron on the flip phone, the frosted tips, you know, it was excruciating. Watch him there squirm. What do you think of Aaron reuniting with Mike McCarthy? Because obviously you work with both guys. Were you surprised, though, that they would be okay working together? Because I think at the end of Green Bay, it seemed to get a little hairy between the two of them.
Yeah, and I think that I talk about this in the book, too, and I may apply to me and the Packers. I just think things get stale after a while, and I think things got stale with Aaron and the Packers. I think things got stale with Mike and the Packers. I think things got stale with Mike and Aaron, and that just happens. You know, it's life. It's personal. It happens in business. It happens in personal, and that happened, and it happens all the time. I don't fault anyone. But fresh starts are fun, you know, and when Mike got the job in Pittsburgh, I'm like, okay, I didn't know if Aaron was going to come back, but I said, if he does come back, same team, you know, familiarity, they still need a quarterback. That's obvious. And people are like, well, why the Steelers? Why did it take so long? And I'm like, first of all, who cares? It doesn't affect your life that Aaron waited until May or whatever. It doesn't affect anything. And the fact is, leverage again, the Steelers left the light on for him, both in 2025 and in 2026. Take your time. Not drafting a high quarterback, all those things. Just, yeah, whenever you're ready. And that's leverage that very few have in sports, you know, that you can just sort of take the offseason, figure it out, and show up. And that's very rare in sports and in life where you have that kind of leverage. But the one thing I'll say about Aaron is that he was – from the moment he got to Green Bay, he was just a favorite of a lot of us in the front office, not only for his on-field skills, you could see his ball mechanics were just off the charts, but he's just kind of dry wit, you know, sense of humor. He'd come up and plop on our, you know, in our offices between me, Reggie McKenzie, John Schneider, just hang out. And we felt it took 3 years, as it did with Jordan Love, where it was time. You know, it was time to hand the keys, bring him out of the bullpen. And then, of course, it worked out.
Yeah, I would say so. You know, there are athletes who enjoy the spotlight. And then there's Aaron Rodgers. You know, he has kind of put himself into a different category now a little bit later into his career. When you first met him, the California cool, sitting on the couch with you and Reggie McKenzie and talking ball, talking life, could you ever have imagined him, you know, starring in his own documentary where he takes ayahuasca in front of the camera. Like, could you have ever imagined he would open up his life in some ways as much as he has?
Yeah, it's just a different time. He was a young guy. He was coming in from Cal, and we joked about it. I'm a Stanford guy. We had a lot of running jokes about that. But he was, I guess, you know, the California cool and the dry wit and the sense of humor, that's always been there. Watching him in the media the past 15 years, obviously. I don't know about the other stuff. You know, again, out of my purview, out of my time frame. Just always, though, honest and good person from what. And again, he was dating a local Green Bay girl, you know, so you fast forward and he's dating movie stars and everything else. A lot changed.
Did you guys have any idea when you were working with him that he was like either estranged from his family or that there was stuff going on in the background? Or was he, did he keep that part completely private from you guys?
Yeah, the latter. I mean, completely private. We never knew about any family, things like that. I was actually close to his agent, Mike Sullivan, who was at Octagon. And, you know, Mike kept a pretty professional relationship with him. So, yeah, we didn't really get into that. Again, the personal stuff was more joking with him about Stanford Cal, and whoever lost the game had to dress in the other colors, the big game every year. And, you know, and then the Brett thing, it was interesting because I was leaving the organization around the same time, but I just told Aaron during that messy divorce, just keep your head down, you know, just don't answer a lot of questions. If you're forced to, deference to Brett. It was a very messy situation. I was hearing from both sides as I was leaving the organization. Brett could not believe after steering this team for 16 years, he wouldn't get his helmet back. And, you know, I just remember hearing from Bus, June 20th, 2008, he was in Mike McCarthy's office and they just walked out. And he said, I can't believe the three words I just heard. And the three words from McCarthy were, we've moved on. And imagine hearing that, you know, so then it was just all problematic about how it was going to happen and when and who, and he wanted to play in the division. And of course we trade him with the Jets where they couldn't trade him in the division. So all, and of course Jets contract ran out. So then he comes back to the division, the whole thing. But, you know, I talk a lot about Brett. I talk about, you know, that weekend in Oakland where it was a great weekend. We had the day off, you know, we flew out on a Saturday. So we're just hanging out Sunday. And we had a Monday night game, and Sunday afternoon, Brett, agent Bus, calls me, and he's usually very jovial, tells me a joke. I'm like, what's up? And he's like, where's Brett? Like, what do you mean? I don't know. Where's Brett? And I said, I don't know. It's a day off, afternoon off. And he said, Irv died. And Big Irv was Brett's father, a coach who was around the organization all the time, big friend of everyone in the organization, heart attack. So then it was like, oh my God, let's find him. And we didn't know where he was. And we finally found him with Doug Peterson and Ryan Longwell out on a golf course. Ryan had gone to Cal. Ryan knew courses out there. Handed the phone from Doug to Brett. Deanna, his wife, told him. He comes back to the hotel and we met him. And he was in tears, but he said, listen, I want you to know right away. He said, I want to play. I just want to play. I want to do it for my dad. And he then told the whole team. And as I said in the book, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. Like, he told the team, I'm going to play for you. And then that Monday night with Madden calling the game, and it seemed like these moon balls were just dropping in our receiver's arms. And then it was just magical. And then 3 days later, we go down to Mississippi, and it was a side of Brett I'd never seen during the funeral. He didn't speak, but that was Brett Favre, the friend, the husband, the cousin, the brother, the community member, the neighbor. That wasn't Brett Favre, superstar quarterback. And that was really a telling moment, spending that day in Hattiesburg at his dad's funeral. Just saw a different side. And I think sometimes people need to know these are human beings. And I talk about that a lot in the book and in all my discussions of these athletes.
You know, I think there'll be people listening to this, Andrew, who will say, well, you know, the headlines about Brett Favre lately have not been so good. You know, what happened with Mississippi, the welfare scandal to try to get things built at his daughter's alma mater, or daughter's university. So what's it like to watch now the fall from grace, and how people don't have the same knowledge that you do of seeing the real person, and now just see the negative headlines?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing I'll say, Meg, is, again, I said this earlier, I don't know how to comment on recent events. I talk about what my experiences were in this book as knowing them for the time that I did, Aaron Brett, Ricky Williams, so many others. And I just can't comment. I don't want to impugn someone based on, hey, look what they did in 2019, and way past when I knew him. But you're right. He has been out of the spotlight. He chimes in now and then. And he has chosen to do that. It's interesting because Aaron is, quote unquote, threatening to do that when he's done, just disappearing and not being a Brady Romo type. But we'll see. The one thing about Brett was, you know, this is sort of emblematic of what happened when we were at the Packers together. The season would end, hopefully late January, February, sometimes early January, and he'd be gone. You know, it'd be, you know, even Bus, and maybe some of this was strategic on Bus's part, I can't find him. You know, he's out in the woods. He's out hunting, fishing. So we'd sort of see him show up. And what was interesting about that is in the summers of 2006 and 2007, it was Aaron's team. You know, Brett was in Mississippi. Aaron ran the team. Mike McCarthy had this quarterback school. And we saw Aaron up close, and we had Donald Driver and Greg Jennings coming up and saying, dude, that guy, wow, he can sling it. So that was instructive, you know, just to sort of see him operate the team as a backup when he was in those summer schools. But again, Brett was unique. He had this teary-eyed press conference, and just something in me, Maggie, said, I don't know. You know, we had been through retirement rumors for years, you know, and I just don't know. I think when the itch of training camp comes back, and of course that happened, that's universal. People find it hard to leave. You know, how many times have we heard about Tom Brady came back, and everyone comes back if they can. And I think it's hard on athletes, you know, to give up in so many different ways.
Absolutely. Is there a memory you have of Aaron and Brett together, like a moment that you'll always remember of the two of them interacting?
In the building, one thing they both had is great senses of humor, their cut-ups. You know, Brett was much different. Brett was wore his emotions on the sleeve. He's farting, burping, slapping guys with towels. You know, he's the life of the party. And Aaron had that, again, wry, sly, reserved sense of humor. But I do remember these times of just those two coming out of a meeting room, or those two in the locker room, and there, I don't know whose joke it was, whether it was Brett's or Aaron's, but they'd be laughing. And I'm looking over at those two, I'm like, good, you know, good. Because again, everyone remembers, like, I'm not here to mentor. Listen, this is not unique to Brett and Aaron. And Aaron, of course, was in the same position with Jordan Love. It's hard. You know, we all don't want to be replaced. And sitting next to your replacement day after day has got to be hard. I felt for Brett. And what I tried to be to both of them during that time was professional and tactful with no right answer, because everyone wanted to know, not only them, but everyone in the community, everyone in the media, like when? Or some people were like, you're not going to give the job to Aaron Rodgers, right? You're going to have a bridge quarterback, Kerry Collins or Jeff Garcia or Chris Chandler, all these names. And I would tell, and Ted would tell, and John would tell, like, no, he's the guy. This is why we did that. Because in the past, we had always drafted quarterbacks low. Ron Wolf always did that, one of whom was my former client, Matthew Hasselbeck. But we'd draft him basically to trade him, you know, like, give them a couple of years in August to show themselves and then trade them. But this was a number one pick. This was different. He's going to play. And that's why when you hear these rumors about number one picks these days, about trading them or about, I'm like, no. They're going to play. Like, you take a quarterback number one, they're going to play. And some people talk about, well, we're going to hold them out a year. No one does that anymore except the Packers. Like, no one. Everyone plays by Thanksgiving, by by Halloween. Heck, even Johnny Manziel played. Like, everyone plays. So this idea that we're going to bring quarterbacks along slowly, nobody except the Packers has even tried that.
And it's, I think, not lost on people. They're also the only team without an owner. Yeah. Who would be maybe pushing for the, you know, the young player to get the, to get in the game, to sell more tickets, to create more buzz, or, you know, something like that. The Packers can kind of operate on timelines maybe that other teams just can't do. I know this seems like I'm only asking about Brett and Aaron. I promise I have more questions if we're good on time. I just have one more Aaron question, because this is, he's acknowledged, you know, this is it. This is the last season, although we'll see. Do you think he really will disappear into the ether, or do you think that he can't stay away? We'll see him in broadcasting, podcasts, other stuff.
Well, first of all, I do believe it's the last year. I do believe that if Mike didn't take the Pittsburgh job, I don't know if he'd come back. You know, this is so comfortable for him. I've always thought it was Steelers or retirement this year, no other team. I think he'll fade away in terms of no TV, no network job, no either game or studio. I don't see it. The only thing I would say maybe he won't fade away is a podcast, something in his words that could be long form, that could be something where, you know, it's his deal. And probably not even, you know, with like a McAfee or someone, just his own deal. I could see that. But listen, he's been silent this offseason, and I think that's kind of a harbinger of what's going to come when he does leave the game. The one thing before we leave the Packers, you just mentioned it. I think the biggest question I get about the Packers in general is, what about this structure and no owner? I talk a lot about this in the book. You know, I always treated working for the Packers as working for a public trust. I had extraordinary authority. You know, whether I did a $5 million contract or a $50 million contract, there's no one saying, hey, Andrew, good job. Andrew, not, that's too much. That's too little. It was like my deal. But I never was awed by that magnitude. And I always acted as if I'm operating on behalf of the shareholders and the cheeseheads and everyone who came up to me and said, hey, how's that Donald Driver contract going? Like, people would just stop me. And I wasn't the coach, I wasn't the GM, I wasn't the president, but everyone knew everyone. And that story I'll tell quickly here. I'm on vacation with my son, but Mark Hadley calls, we got to do a trade. We need a tight end. We're trading with the Bills for a backup tight end. And I'm happy to do it. You know, was the run processing the trades. On the beach in northern Wisconsin, I'm like, phone dies, dead. I look around. All I see up there, Maggie, is a ranger shack. I bring my little son, Sam. We trudge up the hill. And I'm like, to the ranger. I'm like, listen, I'm doing a trade for the Green Bay Packers. Can I use your phone? He's like, what? I'm like, I'm finishing a trade for the Green Bay Packers. My phone died. Can I use your phone? It's a desk phone sitting right there. And I knew I had no shot. So now I actually walk up to him, Maggie. I put my hands on the desk. And I figured, okay, I'll give it a shot. I say, listen, we're trading David Bowen to the Buffalo Bills for a tight end named Bobby Collins, but it won't happen unless I can use your phone the next 10 minutes. And I knew I had him when he looks at me and he goes, we're trading Bowens? And I said, yes, if you let me use your phone, why are we trading Bowens? I said, I'll tell you, just let me use your phone. So I do it. And then I tell him we have surplus at deep end to end. We need a tight end, of course. He goes, Bowens is good. So that's sort of what happens. And, you know, I loved it at the beginning. So cool. You know, you check out of the grocery. Hey, yeah. And my family. But one of the reasons it became time was like, it's a little too insular. You know, I sort of describe it as walls closing in on you, where I couldn't go out of my house and not talk about the Packers. And it just became like, okay, we need kind of a bigger life. Nothing against people who do this all, you know, years and years, but it was time. You know, like I said earlier, it was time.
Yeah, it seems like throughout your career, your timing has been pretty impeccable. I mean, whether it was serendipity, whether it was a little of, you know, hustle, whatever it was, there have been moments where you seem to have been reading the tea leaves and kind of it's worked out for you, which is a good lesson to kind of trust your intuition and trust your instincts. you know, you just mentioned about not having an owner in Green Bay, and it kind of gave you this autonomy. We just saw a sale, the Seattle Seahawks, $9.6 billion or whatever the final number is going to be, which is pretty eye-popping. I'm curious who you think is going to be the next person to possibly sell.
I'll give you a roundabout answer to this. First of all, 2018, David Tepper buys the Panthers for $2.2 billion, and everyone's like, oh my God, you know, that was so much bigger than any others.
He got
amazing.
A deal.
$2.2 billion. 2 years later, no, maybe it was 4 years later, sorry, 2022, the Broncos for 4.6. So they doubled it. They doubled it in 4 years. And then, of course, the Commanders, $6 billion. That's the one that got everyone's attention because, oh my God, Josh Harris, who already owned two professional sports franchises, had a really hard time getting a group together. I have, you know, I'm from DC. I grew up a Redskins fan, as I wrote in the book. And the richest guy I know called me and said, hey, listen, I got this prospectus from Josh Harris. Let me just ask you something. They want about $200 million. And the way I read it, all I get is like good tickets and a parking pass. And I'm like, yeah, that's about it. You know, that's about it for $200 million. Think about that. For $200 million, that's about it. So what has happened is we're in an age where we're running out of multi-billionaires. Obviously, one just came in with Seattle, Kosla, and he's got extraordinary wealth, but there are not a lot of stories. So what happened in 2025 is the NFL allowed for private equity. They were the last league to allow for corporate money, which basically, for people who don't know, is passive investment. These are funds that are buying parts of these teams that have absolutely no control. And the reason why, getting to your question, is I don't know if there's going to be another sale like this because these owners are able to cash out without giving up control. You mentioned the Giants. They cashed out for a $10 billion valuation, selling the Cook family 10% for $1 billion. You have the Eagles, the Bills, the Raiders, the Dolphins have all cashed out in recent years. And when I say cashed out, that is selling fractional shares, 3, 8, 6, 10, 12% for hundreds of millions of dollars. Imagine if you had an asset, you could just cash out hundreds of millions of dollars and lose zero control. You know, these passive funds are having zero input on the coach, the players, who to draft, how to play, nothing, not even what you charge for parking, not even what you charge for the concessions. So it's an extraordinary ability that these owners have, which is why I'm hesitant to even pick an owner that would want to sell. Obviously, unique situation with Seattle and the passing of Paul Allen and the sister that did not want to be the owner. So I'm having a hard time. And you've got all these families. You know, it's always going to be in the Jones family. It's always going to be in the Kraft family. It's always going to be in the Mike Brown family. You know, these are situations, the Arthur Blank family, the Jeffrey Lurie family. You know, this is situations where Jed York family, I don't know if we're going to see sales because family ownership, and, you know, it's going to be an interesting thing. Now, someone like Spanos in San Diego, which is now LA, sorry, maybe, you know, maybe there's a possibility there if I were to just guess.
Want to ask you about the Eagles, a team that you were a consultant for. Didn't know about the Michael Vick thing, that you were basically a go-between when Michael Vick was getting out of prison, literally talking to his agent when he's driving from Leavenworth prison back to Virginia. I mean, that's a slice of history. You know Howie Roseman well. Who do you think lasts longer with the Eagles? Who will be there longer, Nick Sirianni or Jalen Hurts?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm going to say it because I have some, I'm very partial just as a fan. I'm really partial to Jalen Hurts. I think he's underrated. I think that for some reason there are quarterbacks that just don't get the love that they should. Maybe he's not the best reader, the best passer, like, but he wins. And I just think it's an underrated stat. We all know it from people like Michael Vick and Lamar Jackson, but he's really one where it's an underrated stat how many sacks you don't give up. I've seen him escape. His escapability is really something Hurts has, what Andy Reid has, what so many, I think, stars in sports have, which is rare, which is completely flatline. Yeah, Hurts is someone that, oh my God, they're up 20 or down 20. You have no idea. You have no idea. And what's interesting, now we bring it to today's news. Let me just say this quickly. We had A.J. Brown leave Philly, go to Boston. Jaylen Brown leave Boston, go to Philly with similar situations, because this is back to what I said about relationships get stale. Jalen Hurts and A.J. Brown were close. They were really close. And that got stale. No one's fault. No one's fault. And Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum, as I understand it, were very close. That got stale. That changed. No one's fault, right? So this is what happens in sports. And you've sort of allowed me to bring this back to the personalities, and things happen that people don't really understand in sports. It's people, it's ego, it's relationships, it's feelings get hurt. And obviously the Eagles were going to side with Hurts over Brown. And I think they will continue to do that.
I don't know if you saw the video of Jackson Dart doing a backflip off a boat. Now, you've always talked about this time of year, the mid-June through July. You knew if you got a phone call, this was most likely not going to be, you know, a phone call saying you just won the lottery. When you had to go through stuff like this when you were in the NFL or even on the agent side, what's that? Is there a conversation, and what's that like if a guy is acting young and a little reckless?
I think on the agent side, it's, again, as an agent, you're putting in front of them risks and reward. You know, these are the risks. You know, the risks are injury, and the risks are injury that's not paid for by the team. And you obviously have to let people lead their lives. When I talk about being an agent, I talk about you're not just representing the player, you're representing what I call the herd, mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, AAU coaches, pastors, aunts, uncles. And now I'm in the NIL space and I'm dealing with all these people as their agents because they're entering this new world of NIL agency. So I think as an agent, you just have to make them aware, risk and reward. So you choose, but these are the risks. And from a team point of view, as you mentioned, those unrecognizable phone calls in June and July were just death to me. It's like, oh my God, what happened? And I tell the story of hearing about, you know, the issue with the player defecating in the women's laundry hamper in Miami. And Miami was the worst. I hated seeing numbers from Miami. You never know what's going on down there. And again, risk and reward. These are the conversations you have the last day of practice in June. You do what you want, but you realize there are risks. There are risks to that behavior. What's interesting about Dart is, I have a summer home where I am right now at the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. It's a nice resort in the mountains. In about a week's time, who's coming here for a week? The New York Giants. So I'll lecture Jackson Dart on not doing that from my independent perch right now.
I was going to say, I think you might run into Mike Florio there at the Greenbrier, and I'd be curious to see your interaction after writing about him in your book, which was, I didn't know there was a little media beef there, Andrew. You were on his corner there for Sunday Night Football, and I think he got a little territorial.
Yeah, he's on the other part of the state. It's a big state. Okay. So a long way away. But yeah, the media part, which obviously people like you, I entered the media the late in life and with no training. And people like you and so many others, Bob Lee, who obviously wrote my foreword to the book, who I was on, that was my go-to show on ESPN. Outside the Lines, so kind. And you don't have to be. Some people weren't. And whether it was jealousy, whether it was envy, whether it was you're invading my turf, yeah, you just have to deal with that in any business, but you really sort of see when you enter a new business, like I did with media at an advanced age, like who's on your side and who's not, who's a welcoming person, who's not, who is worried about, you know, territory and who's not. And I list a lot of people, especially at ESPN, that were just so kind. And my first hit at ESPN at the combine, you know, when the lockout was about to start, they plop me down between Chris Mortensen, Adam Schefter, and John Clayton and me. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. But again, no training, just feet to the fire.
Well, you're natural. And the book is fantastic. Again, we just scratched the surface. I mean, yeah, there's so much more there. And I wanted to mix a little of the book, but also the current stuff too. And it's just like, it's a great read. You did a fantastic job. And congratulations again.
Thanks so much. And you know, I'll just say this, Maggie. People are going to not like this, maybe. Wasn't that hard? You know, I didn't go to a cabin and research a topic for 6 months. I didn't do interviews. I didn't call people like so many great writers do. I spilled my life and stories. And as you know, I love writing. I've been writing for 15 years, newsletters, columns, other journal. I journal all the time. So yeah, it was a labor of love. And thanks for featuring it. I really appreciate that.
Of course. I see a part two here. I think we're not done. I think there's more stories.
There's a lot more in that 40,000 words that was cut. Yeah. There's a lot more.
The sequel.